This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Borders are, quote-unquote, important. They define, in legal terms, who we are, our identity, and our rights. Except borders are rarely imposed with any thought to the people actually living there. And once a border is imposed, it can radically change the lives of those who live alongside it, dividing communities forevermore. India's border, imposed by colonial authorities and disputed by successor governments, makes this clear. Midnight's Borders, a People's History of Modern India, published by Melville House in late May, sees author Suchitra Vijayan travel along India's vast land border to meet the people who live there, and investigates how lives have been affected by geopolitics, colonialism, state violence, ethnic strife, and corruption. Suchitra Vijayan is the founder and executive director of the Polis Project, a hybrid research and journalism organization. A barrister by training, she previously worked for the United Nations War Crimes Tribunals in Yugoslavia and Rwanda before co-founding the Resettlement Legal Aid Project in Cairo, which gives legal aid to Iraqi refugees. Her work has appeared in The Washington Post, GQ, The Boston Review, The Hindu, and Foreign Policy. Today, Suchitra and I will talk about India's border regions, with Afghanistan, China, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Myanmar. We talk about the lives of those that live in these borderlands, and why she chose to call this book A People's History. So, Suchitra, thank you so much for joining me on the Asian Review of Books podcast. I'd like to start, actually, with the last part of that introduction. What makes this book a people's history? How has this framing affected how you approach this topic and structured the book?
Thank you so much for having me. Big fan of the New Books Network and the podcast. So I'm really glad to be having this conversation. The people's history is something that that I've been inspired by reading people like Edward Said, Zinn, and many others who made it important to not just look at the state's version of the history, but look at communities, especially communities that have fought against state violence, demanded a certain kind of dignity and freedom and right to exist as equal people. And that is true of many of the border communities, whether it is South Asia, whether we look at what's happening in the U.S.-Mexico border, or anywhere in the world where communities are still trying to not only fight for that sense of freedom and dignity, but also reclaim their histories. And I think the idea of reclaiming that history is absolutely important, because who gets to tell that history, who gets to map these histories, becomes very contentious when you think about who gets to tell their stories. While the book itself draws inspiration from many of the work that was produced by the New Left I did not want to write a book that was similar to Zinn's A People's History of the United States, which I think is the most famous book that carries the idea of history from below, because Zinn tries to respond to a history of the United States in a very specific way. When I thought about the people's history, I was thinking about those who are interviewed as collaborators in this book, the way this book was put together, the ways in which these conversations were about not giving the voiceless, giving voice to the voiceless, which is often used as a way for those of us who are immensely privileged to parachute into communities and tell other people's stories. Rather, the idea was to acknowledge upfront that the people in this book are eloquent voices. They are articulate about their political realities, their histories. And what I really wanted to do was make them collaborators in this project. And the structure of the book in some ways was defined by this, because as the book was being written, a lot happened in India with the CAA NRC protests, with the rise of a very Hindu nationalist government. Because when I started the book, it was 2013. And by the time I was done, India was radically transformed. So many of the people who were essentially part of the book later became very afraid for their life, which meant that a lot of the stories in the book did not make it. As the final manuscript was being written, the structure fell apart. And in some ways, the book was again put together with those who still wanted to be in the book. And in some ways, it also realizing that all stories don't have to be told. Telling the story of someone is also an immense act of privilege. And it's an act of radical politics.
So why focus on the idea of a border in particular?
Because for someone like me, and I'm sure that's true of many of us, borders are ubiquitous. Where we are born, to whom we are born, what passports we have, completely and fundamentally dictate the life that we're going to have. It's a piece of paper that defines whether you're going to be a nomad, a traveler, an immigrant, a refugee, or someone who is fleeing violence. Especially if you're a brown or a black body, and I think that has a lot of ramifications. But more importantly, I think it was my own experience of travel, of being a small brown woman. For the longest of time, I had an Indian passport. In many places, I'm still the only person of color. I remember in my cohort at Yale, I was the only person of color. We had no African-American students or black students. Even those of us who were brown came from immense privilege of, if not wealth. I didn't come from the privilege of wealth, but I definitely came from the privilege of caste and class. So these things became very clear that often what one sees or where one ends up in life as a direct correlation to where you were born. And borders are creations not only of the empire and the colony, but they fundamentally make unequal people. And making unequal people is fundamental to the way the world works. There's a reason why two people who are exactly qualified can be paid two different salaries simply because of where they exist. This is why some people can travel, call themselves nomads, travel in the middle of a pandemic, become travel influencers, while others, even when they travel and demand and fight for dignity, when they flee violence, are still treated as criminal. Recently, Kamala Harris, the U.S. Vice President, when in our first international travel, said, "Please do not come," which is a direct violation of international laws. So I think that was very essential. But also borders are not the outside, borders are everywhere. And they can be, they are immensely important ways for us to think about the state, about citizenship, about belonging. And they just offer rich ways for us to think and have conversations about what all of these ideas of freedom, dignity, and citizenship mean.
So could you run through, this is a difficult question, but could you run through the history of India's border? Who set them and how were they set?
Sure. Today's, subcontinent's borders are usually categorized in studies, studied as three main lines. You have the border that gave birth to Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, India. And the lines are the Durand line, the Radcliffe line, and the McMahon line. Unsurprisingly, these lines are named after British civil servants who knew very little about the region that they not only divided, but came to administer and rule. Of course, the Mortimer Durand line, which was created in 1893, is the oldest of them. It was an agreement between Mortimer Durand, who was a British civil servant, and the Emir Abdurrahman Khan, the King of Afghanistan. And the agreement was actually a single page document. It really didn't have a great detail. It had seven clauses that created not a border, but a frontier. And once the British forces left, Pakistan then inherits the Durand line as a de facto border after 1947. And 1947 becomes important because 1947 is when the subcontinent gets partitioned between the Hindu majority India and the Muslim majority Pakistan, both East and West Pakistan. So Radcliffe Line was demarcated in 1947 during the time of the partition. Today, the Western Line still serves as the India-Pakistan border, and the Eastern Line serves as the India-Bangladesh border. The McMahon line runs between India and China, and this was a result of a 1914 agreement between the British and the Tibetan representatives. China, of course, has refused to accept the McMahon line and disputes a lot of India's claims over the northeastern state of Arunachal Pradesh. And what's interesting is that China does not refer to Arunachal Pradesh as Arunachal Pradesh, but calls it Southern Tibet. Meanwhile, India continues to lay claims to parts of Chinese-controlled northern Kashmir, which is then ceded to China by Pakistan in the remote Aksai Chin region. So what you're really seeing is multiple lines, but eventually lines that were born out of a colonial rule and administration, which continue to be deeply contested.
So for those people who don't get to travel to these places, and as you note in the book, it's often actually very difficult to, what are these borderlands like? What's the physical landscape? And more importantly for your book, who actually lives there?
The borderlands is a very... The borderlands come in all shapes and forms. And before I talk about the borderlands, I think it's very important for us to acknowledge that not everybody gets to travel in these spaces. Who you are, how you look, what privileges you have can all define not only what the borderlands is for you, but also what interactions that you have with the borderlands. One thing that I found traveling through India as land borders is contested land borders, because not everybody agrees even that these land borders, how India sees its borders is very different than what, say, Pakistan sees it. Or, of course, you have Kashmiris who have been fighting for self-determination for a really long time. So these borders themselves, there's no one agrees on where these lines begin and end to start with. Second, even as these contested places exist, the world changes every 100 feet. No two places are the same. And often what really changes is not only how people are treated, but who gets treated how. For example, a Bengali Muslim farmer without documents in the same borderlands is treated very differently from someone else. And that changes over and over again. In all of these places, history and memory is very, very local. So one of the efforts of this book is also to try and not generalize these places. Having said that, there are certain things that are happening, and they're happening at various varying levels in these spaces. One is the immense militarization that is happening. While Kashmir is the world's most militarized border, we cannot take away the fact excuse me, we cannot take away the fact that the other borders, like the India-Bangla borderlands, are also severely getting militarized. The crisis in Myanmar means that the refugee flow continues and it's ongoing, and that lends to a different kind of militarization. You see in parts of the border with China, the militarization is completely different. But what you're really seeing in all of these spaces is the military footprint that is increasing. And along with it, you have more men with boots, you see more bunkers, you see an extensive act of surveillance, you see appropriation of land, and more importantly, less and less rights for these bordered populations who live there.
So Midnight's Borders starts with Afghanistan. Why do you start there? And what did you see when you went to visit that region?
It's a great question. It's also the foundational story of this book. I never thought that I would be writing a book about the border. What really happened was I left high school soon after 9/11. And I was a young person coming into adulthood in an age of dystopia, birthed by the global war on terror. I was also a dark-skinned brown immigrant woman who left home to study elsewhere. For the first time, as a young person, I was confronting a very specific kind of racialized violence that was everywhere. Of course, I saw this play out more for my brown and black friends, especially Muslim friends. And the war in Afghanistan was a constant, was always just there. I saw my friends being frisked. I saw so much that was inflicted in the name of security. And the war in Iraq started, and then Abu Ghraib images coming out. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I just really wanted to go to Afghanistan and just understand what was happening. Not so much in terms of, oh, why did they do this to us, which was a very Orientalist way of looking at this, but understanding what had happened to a country in the aftermath of that. And 10 years later, in about 2010, I did finally go to Afghanistan. When I went there, I was a graduate student at Yale, and the questions I went there with was very different. The question I went there with was trying to understand why had the world's largest territorial army, the United States, had failed so miserably. But once I was embedding and I was at the border, it became very clear that that question that I went there with was actually quite incomplete, and what I was seeing was a lot more expansive. Traveling this porous border, now a site of not one, but three generations of war, the way in which imperial violence, both by Russia, the United States, and Britain, had affected these communities, and how these borders can become an important way of telling the story of a war that was really not told the way as I was seeing it. And then that led me to travel the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. And when I came back home, I still wonder how that idea came in. I just asked myself, what would I find if I traveled India's land border? I was also much younger. It was 8 years ago, and I was much younger, and I had oodles of enthusiasm, and I believed this entire project could be done in a few months, but I didn't realize it was going to take me 8 years. The more I traveled, I think I changed. I learned. And that's why the book starts with the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. And another reason is that for many of the Afghans that I met, the racial memory was a border was not with Pakistan. It was not even with India as we think of it now. It was with a frontiered land where Afghans could travel from Peshawar all the way to Calcutta. And they were cultural, political relationships that went farther than the millennia. And all of that was severed, was completely butchered. And even in Paktika province where I was, it was very common for Afghan men to travel to Hyderabad in India or Calcutta or Bihar to find wives and bring them back home. So in that sense, even starting with Afghanistan, Pakistan was a way to destabilize our ideas of what South Asia should look like. Where does the borders of the Indian subcontinent begin and end?
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
So I'd like to shift now to talking about the borders in India's northeast, the borders with Bangladesh and Myanmar. I think a lot of the stories you bring up from that region are focused on the treatment of those deemed to be quote unquote illegal migrants. And I think as you and I both know, that term is problematic, hence my use of the term, hence me saying quote unquote. But who exactly are these populations and how has the majority treated them?
The reality is that the problem or often the challenge that a writer or a researcher or a scholar faces in these places is to actually problematize what does it mean to think about these populations, but also when and where do these populations belong? Where is a timeline of belonging, right? For instance, I haven't lived in India for the last 17 years of my life. And does my belonging end the moment I leave? Or does my belonging to a place begin the moment I start living? Assuming my child tomorrow is born in a different place, where would their histories of belonging begin? Assuming I live here and my generations continue to live in the United States, when do they become as people who belong to this land, right? So when is the timeline and how do we think about this? And often what you really see is that this region is a region that has gone through multiple acts of migration, multiple acts of conquest. There's travel, and people travel for many reasons. And often migration is fueled not only by work, it's also fueled by climate change, it's fueled by violence. So to start with it, I think it's very important for us to kind of lay out those very fundamental threads that a people in a land are never static and it keep changing. And in this large chapter, there are three chapters. One looks at the massacre that happens in Nellie, which targets Muslim villages because it's a belief that these are illegal migrants and a massacre that kind of plays out. While many of them have been people who've lived in this land for a really long time. And the other chapter looks at, it's called The Tale of Three Detention, looks at three individuals who were detained as foreigners or illegals, illegal migrants. And in the book, I very clearly say that somebody might be undocumented, but nobody can be illegal. One is the figure of a Rohingya refugee who makes his way into India, leaving violence. And very quickly gets arrested and is held as incarcerated for over a decade, even though he's already served a sentence, because illegally crossing a border that he was charged with is only a few years. And he just languishes there for years and years and years. And in that chapter, you tell a story of how the crisis of statelessness was created in Myanmar, how those who were citizens were very quickly transformed into non-citizens and now refugees, and the history is erased. And that then becomes a background to tell how a similar story is playing out in India, where two women, both born and raised in modern-day Assam, whose families have long histories here, are again treated as foreigners and held and wrongfully incarcerated. And these are two instances where the women are lucky and they leave, but even the ordeal that they go through is very quickly reflective of what's happening. While majority of these communities tend to be Muslims, in reality, there are also Hindus who are Hindu Bengali migrants who come into Assam soon after the partition, who are being held because they don't have enough documentation. So what you really see is a story of bureaucratic violence, and also deciding how someone is a citizen or not based on very arbitrary procedural grounds.
Right. And I think, as we know, over the past year in India, if not, she went since the passage of the kind of controversial Citizenship Acts, it's becoming, I think, quite explicit how the Indian government sees who is or who is not a quote unquote Indian.
Yeah. Also, there can only be one kind of an Indian, and you have to be Hindu, you have to be upper caste, you can only believe in a certain kind of God, you can only eat a certain kind of food. So it's basically collapsing the rich diversity of what it means to belong to multiplicities into one. For instance, I'm born to a Hindu father. But my parents come from two different castes, speak different languages. At home, I grew up speaking English because my parents both spoke two different languages. But the food that I ate was rich. It was rich because it was so cosmopolitan. The food had Muslim influences, the Deccan influences. Because I was by an ocean, there's the richness of the seafood, the dialects, the spices. Imagine taking all of that away and collapsing all of us into these singular, unitary individuals who have to fit into these perfect cookie-cutter molds of what a Hindu nationalist government wants us to be.
So I want to shift now to perhaps the most critical is the word I would use, but it's perhaps not the best one, but the most critical border, the border between India and Pakistan. How has this border kind of loomed in the minds of both those people that live along the border and around India and Pakistan more generally?
I think it's very important for us to understand why Pakistan looms so large in the political and historical memory. One, it is not the most critical border, and I think all borders of India are both critical and contested, and it really depends on which border gets a disproportionate attention, and it's because the border with Pakistan. And that is because of partition. 17.8 million people exchanged homes. This was nothing short of a Holocaust. Both communities lost families, homes, women were raped, it's just painful in so many ways. And I think that kind of is still there. Second, we cannot take away from the fact that both the governments of India and Pakistan have very strategically weaponized the violence and the pain of the partition into a discourse that is deeply hyper-nationalistic. So today, if someone says Pakistani, it is almost as a proxy for calling someone a Muslim. But such characterizations are problematic because India is also home to a vast Muslim population. India is a secular democracy, at least it used to be one on paper. And I think those are all things that we forget. But in reality, when I travel through the border, what I saw was not hatred to Pakistan. What I saw was ways in which India's own military practices were affecting its people, whether it's Operation Pokhran, where farmlands were used for military, a very aggressive military posturing. The chapter of Sari Begum, where she talks about the bunkers being put in a land. And there's a very beautiful line that she says, everything bad that happened to me happened in this village. Nobody from Pakistan came and did this to me. And I think there's a sense of, because you're constantly next to the sense of looming danger, and I think people actually have an immense sense of moral clarity about what's happening. Also, let's not forget that Punjab region, which forms a large chunk of the border with Pakistan, actually went through one of the worst forms of state violence with the disappearances, with the violence against the Sikh community. Similarly, in the borders in Rajasthan and Gujarat, you see a different kind of militarization. But increasingly, what you see is the Indian state's own violence against its own people in the name of protecting the border. Of course, it doesn't take away from the historical memory of the violence that many of these communities experienced and continue to live with. And I think that's one of the reasons why this border perhaps looms larger. Also, it appears in Bollywood films. I think there's just so much, you know, that we are told early on that this is also one of the reasons why I feel the border just looms large.
So I have one more question, or actually two more questions, but I'll ask them together. First of all, since you finished writing the book and since the book's been published, what's happened in India and elsewhere in South Asia kind of around these issues and these regions you're talking about? And just to kind of build on that, since the book's been published, what's been the reaction from readers in South Asia?
I think the book was written, so my book manuscript was due towards the end of 2019, and that's when so much happened between August and December of 2019. Article 370 was revoked in Kashmir. You had the Babri Masjid decision, you had the CAA-NRC protests, there was a Shaheen Bagh protest, there was a pro-democracy protest that just flourished in India. I was in India during the time, so I was part of these protests, I was traveling. And I wrote this, when I was putting this together, you know, there's always the anxiety of a writer of trying to make a deadline. But also there was a sense of hope. That I think you had to be there to see what Shaheen Bagh meant, what these protest sites meant to people. I had never felt so happy and proud. But then soon after the JNU violence happened, I was at JNU that night, outside the gates. We heard, I was there for a conference and we heard students were being attacked, and quickly a bunch of us jumped in a car and went out. And we saw the spectacle that happened, how the police refused to protect the students, but aided those who were attacking the students. And soon after, the February violence in Delhi happened. And you saw how an afraid state was cracking down on dissent. And the only way they knew to crack down on dissent was by unleashing an unprecedented violence. I mean, they're still digging out bodies from the canals, from February of last year. And then the COVID pandemic happened. And as I revised and rewrote the book, I wrote it with an immense sense of loss. I felt that something had profoundly broken. But writing the book was important to me because I felt that I was telling a story that was important. While the story had started much before, it was important. But as we came close to putting the book together, since the book was going to be released in India and in the US and UK, and India has a different publisher, we wanted to be sure that my publisher was convinced that I was going to be charged with sedition. And I think it was because the COVID pandemic happened that I wasn't charged, because the government had other things to do. And then we did a legal edit. And it came back with sentences saying, oh, this could be sedition, that. And one thing that we went ahead, and I'm immensely grateful for my publishers who stood and fought for this book, is that I wrote everything that I wanted to write with absolute truth and integrity. I did not take anything out. The book is heavily sourced and cited, but that's how the book went out, knowing very well that there could be something that was coming. The book has not been covered as much by the mainstream. The progressives and the smaller publications have covered it. But the book has been selling. The audience have still discovered it. Every single week since the book has been published, every week I get emails and messages and texts saying that this book was something that this is their story. Either I get messages saying that this is their family's history that they're rereading through somebody else, or I get messages saying that they never knew these things happened. So it's quite interesting to see that while there's been absolute silence with the mainstream, because I've also been very critical of many of those who are editors and publishers of these mainstream spaces. The audience has still found the book. I mean, it's still quite early. It's still only a few months since the book came out. The only thing that I can hope is that more people find the time to read the book, but more importantly, the empathy to engage with the book.
So I think that's a great place to end our interview with Suchitra Vijayan, the author of Midnight's Borders, A People's History of Modern India. Suchitra, I actually have one more question, if you don't mind. And my last question is, where else can people find your work? And what's next for you?
Where else can people find my work? I'm not a journalist in the traditional sense. I'm a writer and I'm a researcher. So almost everything I write is either on my website or appears as essays. What next? I think it took me a really long time to be in a place where I get up every morning and I absolutely love the work I do. My work is not work. It's important. I get to read. I get to write. I get to engage with things that matter to me. I get to work with incredibly smart, committed people who are fighting for rights, who continue to speak on behalf of others, who continue to challenge the state. So in that sense, I think I will continue doing what I already do. The next big adventure would be I'm trying to write fiction, which I realize is incredibly difficult. I'm learning. I don't know if I'll be any good. I don't know if I'll ever get to do anything with it. But I have immense respect for writers of fiction now, simply because it's reality is easier to write. Fiction is just, it's harder. And that's it. And I'm hopefully, I also but more importantly, I just wish I get to see the great joy of being me and my life is that I've had the remarkable gift of meeting some incredible people over the years. Many of them are committed activists, writers, thinkers who continue to fight. And hopefully I get to see some of them soon. So hopefully that's the near future and the longer future.
Well, I wish you luck on your writing journey, especially in fiction. So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at @BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com. We hope you've been listening to the Asian Review Books podcast, now found on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends. If you want us to continue to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned to learn more about who's coming up on the show. But before then, thank you so much, Suchitra, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.